Green Mars, Cassette 17.
One evening in the late summer of M year 49, they walked down with Spencer to the cafe and sat through the long twilight, watching dark copper clouds that sat glowing over the distant ice under the purple sky. The prevailing westerlies drove air masses up over the Hellespontus so that dramatic fronts of cloud over the ice were part of their daily life, but some clouds were special. Metallic, lobed, solid objects, like mineral statues which could never just waft away on a wind, spitting lightning from their black bottoms onto the ice below. And then, as they watched these particular statues, there was a low rumble, and the ground trembled slightly underfoot, and the silverware chattered across the table. They grabbed their glasses and stood, along with everyone else in the cafe, and in the shocked silence, Maya saw they were all automatically looking to the south, out toward the ice. People were pouring out of the park onto the Corniche, and then standing against the tent wall in silence, looking outward. There, in the fading indigo of sunset, under the copper clouds, it was just possible to see movement, a winking black and white at the edge of the white and black mass, moving toward them across the plain. "Water," someone at the next table said. Everyone moved as if in a tractor beam, glasses in hand, all other thoughts gone as they came to the tent coping at the edge of the waterfront and stood together against the chest-high wall, squinting into the shadows on the plain, black on black, with a salting of white spots tumbling this way and that. For a second, Maya recalled again the Marineris flood, and she shuddered, forcing the memory back down like chyme in her esophagus, choking slightly on the acidity, doing her best to kill that part of her mind. It was the Hellas Sea coming toward her, her sea, her idea, now inundating the slope of the basin. A million plants were dying, as Sax had taught her to remember. The low-point melt pod had been getting bigger and bigger, connecting up to other pods of liquid water, melting the rotten ice between and around them, warmed by the long summer and the bacteria and the surges of steam from explosions set in the surrounding ice. One of the northern ice walls must have broken, and now the flood was blackening the plain south of Odessa. The nearest edge was no more than 15 kilometers away. Now most of what they could see of the basin was a salt and pepper jumble, the predominant pepper in the foreground shifting even as they watched to more and more salt, the land lightening at the same time that the sky was darkening, which, as always, gave things an unnatural aspect. Frost steam swirled up from the water, glowing with what looked to be reflected light from Odessa itself. Perhaps half an hour passed, with everyone on the Corniche standing still and watching, in a general silence that only began to end when the flood was frozen and the twilight ended. Then there was a sudden return of human voices and electric music from a cafe two down. A peal of laughter. Maya went to the bar and ordered champagne for the table, feeling her high spirits sizzle. For once her mood was in tune with events, and she was ready to celebrate the bizarre sight of their own powers unleashed, lying out there on the landscape for their inspection. She offered a toast to the cafe at large. "To the Hellas Sea, and all the sailors who will sail it, dodging icebergs and storms to reach the far shore." Everyone cheered, and people all up and down the Corniche picked it up and cheered as well. A wild moment. The gypsy band struck up a tango version of a sea shanty, and Maya felt the small smile shifting the stiff skin of her cheeks for the entire rest of that evening. Even a long discussion of the possibility of another surge washing up and over Odessa's seawall couldn't take that smile off her face. Down at the office, they had calculated the possibilities very finely indeed, and any slop over, as they called it, was unlikely or even impossible. Odessa would be all right. But news kept flooding in from afar, threatening to overwhelm them in its own way. On Earth, the wars in Nigeria and Azania had caused bitter worldwide economic conflict between Arms Corps and Subarashi. Christian, Muslim, and Hindu fundamentalists were all making a vice of necessity and declaring the longevity treatment the work of Satan. Great numbers of the untreated were joining these movements, taking over local governments and making direct, human-wave assaults on the metanational operations within their reach. Meanwhile, all the big metanationals were trying to resuscitate the UN and put it forth as an alternative to the World Court, and many of the biggest Metanat clients, and now the Group of 11, were going along with it. Michelle considered this a victory, as it again showed fear of the World Court. And any strengthening of an international body like the UN, he said, was better than none. But now there were two competing arbitration systems erected, one controlled by the Metanats, which made it easier to avoid the one they didn't like. And on Mars, things were little better. The UNTA police were roving in the south, unhindered except by occasional unexplained explosions among their robot vehicles, and Prometheus was the latest hidden sanctuary to have been discovered and shut down. Of all the big sanctuaries, only Vishniac remained hidden, and they had gone dormant in an effort to stay that way. The South Polar region was no longer part of the underground. In this context, it was no surprise to see how frightened the people who came to the meeting sometimes were. It took courage to join an underground that was visibly shrinking, like Minus One Island. People were driven to it by anger, Maya supposed, and indignation and hope. But they were frightened as well. There was no assurance that this move would do any good. And it would be so easy to plant a spy among these newcomers. Maya found it hard to trust them sometimes. Could all of them be what they claimed to be? It was impossible to be sure of that. Impossible. One night at a meeting with a lot of newcomers, there was a young man in the front with a look she didn't like, and after the meeting, which was uninspired, she had gone with Spencer's friends right back to the apartment and told Michelle about it. "Don't worry," he said.
"What do you mean, don't worry?"
He shrugged. "The members keep track of each other. They try to make sure they're all known to each other, and Spencer's team is armed."
"You never told me that."
"I thought you knew."
"Come on, don't treat me as if I was stupid."
"I don't, Maya. Anyway, it's all we can do unless we hide entirely."
"I'm not proposing to do that." "What do you think I am, a coward?"
A sour expression crossed his face, and he said something in French. Then he took a deep breath and shouted at her in French, one of his curses. But she could see that this was a deliberate decision on his part, that he had decided the fights were good for her and cathartic for him, so that they could be pursued, when inevitable, as a kind of therapeutic method. And this, of course, was intolerable. An act, a manipulation of her. Without another thought, she took a step into the kitchen area and picked up a copper pot and heaved it at him, and he was so surprised that he barely managed to knock it away.
"Putain!"
he roared.
"Pourquoi c'est ça? Pourquoi?"
"I won't be patronized," she told him, satisfied that he was genuinely angry now, but still blazing herself.
"You damned head-shrinker! If you weren't so bad at your job, the whole first 100 wouldn't have gone crazy, and this world wouldn't be so fucked up. It's all your fault."
And she slammed out the door and went down to the cafe to brood over the awfulness of having a shrink as a partner, also over her own ugly behavior, so quick to leap out of her control and attack him. He did not come down and join her that time, though she sat around till closing. And then, just after she had gotten home and lain down on the couch and fallen asleep, there was a knock at the door, rapid and light in a way immediately frightening, and Michelle ran to it and looked through the peephole. He saw who it was and let her in. It was Marina. Marina sat down heavily on the couch beside Maya and, with shaking hands holding theirs, said, "They took over Sabishi."
Security troops, Hiroko and her whole inner circle were there visiting, as well as all the southerners who had come up since the raids, and Coyote, too. All of them were there, and Nanao and Etsu and all the Issei. Didn't they resist? Maya said.
They tried. There were a bunch of people killed at the train station. That slowed them down, and I think some people might have gotten into the Moho Mound maze. But they had surrounded the whole area, and they came in through the tent walls. It was just like Cairo in 61, I swear.
Suddenly she started to cry, and Maya and Michelle sat down on each side of her, and she put her face in her hands and sobbed. This was so out of character for the usually severe Marina that the reality of her news hit home. She sat up and wiped her eyes and nose. Michelle got her a tissue. Calmly, she went on. I'm afraid a lot of them may be killed. I was out with Vlad and Ursula in one of those outlying hermitage boulders, and we stayed there for 3 days and then walked to one of the hidden garages and got out in boulder cars. Vlad went to Burrows, Ursula to Elysium. We're trying to tell as many of the first 100 as we can, especially Sax and Nadia. Maya got up and put on her clothes, then went down the hall and knocked on Spencer's door. She returned to the kitchen and put on water for tea, refusing to look at the photo of Frank, who watched her, saying, I told you so. This is the way it happens. She took teacups back into the living room and saw that her own hands were shaking so much that hot liquid was spilling down over her fingers. Michelle's face was pale and sweaty, and he wasn't hearing anything Marina was saying. Of course. If Hiroko's group had been there, then his entire family was gone, either captured or killed. She handed out the teacups, and as Spencer came in and had the story told to him, she got a robe and draped it over Michelle's shoulders, excoriating herself for the miserable timing of her assault on him. She sat by him, squeezing his thigh, trying to tell him by touch that she was there, that she was his family too, and that all her games were over to the best of her ability, no more treating him as pet or punching bag, that she loved him. But his thigh was like warm ceramic, and he obviously didn't notice her hand, was scarcely even aware she was there. And it came to her that it was precisely in the moments of greatest need, when people could do the least for each other. She got up and got Spencer some tea, avoiding looking at the photo or the pale image of her face in the dark kitchen window, the pinched, bleak vulture eye that she could never meet. You can never look back. For the moment, there was nothing to do but sit there and get through the night, try to absorb the news, to withstand it. So they sat, they talked, they listened to Marina tell her story in greater and greater detail. They made calls out on the Praxis lines, trying to find out more. They sat, slumped and silent, caged in their own reflections, their solitary universes. The minutes passed like hours, the hours like years. It was the hellish, twisted space-time of the all-night vigil, that most ancient of human rituals, where people fought without success to wrench meaning into each random catastrophe. Dawn, when it finally came, was overcast, the tents spattered with raindrops. A few painfully slow hours later, Spencer began the process of contacting all the groups in Odessa. Over the course of that day and the next, they spread the news which had been suppressed on Mangalavid and the other infinites. But it was clear to all that something had happened because of the sudden absence of Sabishi from the ordinary discourse, even in matters of common business. Rumors flew everywhere, gaining momentum in the absence of hard news, rumors of everything from Sabishi's independence to its raising. But in the tense meetings of the following week, Maya and Spencer told everyone what Marina had said, and then they spent the subsequent hours discussing what should be done. Maya did her best to convince people that they shouldn't be pushed into acting before they were ready, but it was hard going. They were furious and frightened, and there were a lot of incidents in town and around Hellas that week, all over Mars, in fact.
demonstrations, minor sabotage, assaults on security positions and personnel, AI breakdowns, work slowdowns.
"We've got to show them they can't get away with this," Jackie said over the net, seeming everywhere at once.
Even Art agreed with her.
"I think civil protests by as much of the general population as we can muster might slow them down. Make those bastards think twice about doing anything like this again."
Nevertheless, the situation stabilized after a while. Sabishi returned to the net and to train schedules, and life there resumed, although it wasn't the same as before, as a big police force stayed in occupation, monitoring the gates and the station, and trying to discover all the cavities of the mound maze. During this time, Maya had a number of long talks with Nadia, who was working in South Fossa, and with Nirgal and Art, and even with Anne, who called in from one of her refuges in the Aurium chaos. They all agreed that no matter what had happened in Sabishi, they needed to hold back for the moment from any attempt at a general insurrection. Sax even called in to Spencer to say he needed time, which Maya found comforting as it supported her gut feeling that the time wasn't right, that they were being provoked in the hopes they would try a revolt prematurely. Anne and Cassay and Jackie and the other radicals, Dao, Antar, even Zake, were unhappy at the wait and pessimistic about what it meant. "You don't understand," Maya told them. "There's a whole new world growing out there, and the longer we wait, the stronger it gets. Just hold on." Then about a month after the closing of Sabishi, they got a brief message on their wrists from Coyote, a short clip of his lopsided face looking unusually serious, telling them that he had gotten away through the maze of secret tunnels in the Mohole Mound and was now back in the south in one of his own hideouts. "What about Hiroko?" Michelle said instantly. "What about Hiroko and the rest of them?" But Coyote was already gone. "I don't think they got Hiroko either," Michelle said instantly, walking around the room without noticing he was moving. "Not Hiroko or any of them. If they had been captured, I'm sure the Transitional Authority would have announced it. I'll bet Hiroko has taken the group underground again. They haven't been pleased with things since Dorsa Brevia. They're just not good at compromise. That's why they took off in the first place. Everything that has happened since has only confirmed their opinion that they can't trust us to build the kind of world they want. So they've used this chance and disappeared again. Maybe the crackdown on Sabishi forced them to do it without warning us."
"Maybe so," Maya said, careful to sound like she believed it.
It sounded like denial on Michelle's part, but if it helped him, who cared? And Hiroko was capable of anything. But Maya had to make her response plausibly Maya-like, or he would see she was only reassuring him.
"But where would they go?"
"Back to the chaos, I would guess. A lot of the old shelters are still there."
"But what about you?"
"They'll let me know." He thought it over, looked at her. "Or maybe they figure that you're my family now." So he had felt her hand in that first horrible hour. But he gave her such a sad, crooked smile that she winced and caught him up and tried to crush him with a hug, really crack a rib, to show him how much she loved him and how little she liked such a wan look.
"They're right about that," she said harshly. "But they ought to contact you anyway."
"They will. I'm sure they will." Maya had no idea what to think of this theory of Michelle's. Coyote had in fact escaped through the mound maze, and he was likely to have helped as many of his friends as he could, and Hiroko would probably be first on that list. She would certainly grill Coyote about it next time she saw him. But then he had never told her anything before. In any case, Hiroko and her inner circle were gone. Dead, captured, or in hiding, no matter which it was, a cruel blow to the cause, Hiroko being the moral center for so much of the resistance. But she had been so strange, A part of Maya, mostly subconscious and unacknowledged, was not entirely unhappy to have Hiroko off the scene, however it had happened. Maya had never been able to communicate with Hiroko, to understand her, and though she had loved her, it had made her nervous to have such a great random force wandering about, complicating things. And it had been irritating also to have another great power among the women, a power that she had had absolutely no influence over. Of course it was horrible if the whole of her group had been captured, or worse, killed. But if they had decided to disappear again, that wouldn't be a bad thing at all. It would simplify things at a time when they desperately needed simplification, giving Maya more potential control over the events to come. So she hoped with all her heart that Michelle's theory was true, and nodded at him, and pretended to agree in a reserved, realistic way with his analysis. And then went off to the next meeting, to calm down yet another commune of angry natives. Weeks passed, then months. It seemed they had survived the crisis. But things were still degenerating on Earth, and Sabishi, their university town, the jewel of the Demimonde, was functioning under a kind of martial law. And Hiroko was gone, Hiroko, who was their heart. Even Maya, initially pleased in some sense to be rid of her, felt more and more oppressed by her absence. The concept of free Mars had been part of the Areophany, after all, and to be reduced to mere politics, to the survival of the fittest, the spirit seemed gone from things. And as the winter passed and the news from Earth told of escalating conflicts, Maya noticed that people seemed more and more desperate for distraction. The partying got louder and wilder. The Cornish was a nightly celebration, and on special nights like Fastnacht or New Year's, it was jammed with everyone in town, all dancing and drinking and singing with a kind of ferocious gaiety under the little red mottos painted on every other wall. You can never go back. Free Mars. But how? How? New Year's that winter was especially wild. It was M-Year 50, and people were celebrating the big anniversary in style. Maya walked with Michelle up and down the Cornish, and from behind her domino she watched curiously as the undulating dance lines passed them by. She stared at all the long, young dancing bodies, the figures masked but naked to the waist for the most part, as if out of an ancient Hindu illustration, breasts and pecs bobbing gracefully to Nuevo Calypso steel drum ponking. Oh, it was strange. And these young aliens were ignorant, but how beautiful. How beautiful. And this town she had helped to build, standing over its dry waterfront. She felt herself taking off inside, past the equinox and into the glorious rush to euphoria, and maybe it was only an accident of her biochemistry, probably so, given the grim situation of the two worlds, Entre Chien et Loup, but nevertheless it existed, and she felt it in her body. And so she pulled Michelle into a dance line and danced until she was slippery with sweat. It felt great. For a while they sat together in her café. Quite a little reunion of the first 39, as it turned out. She and Michelle and Spencer, and Vlad and Ursula and Marina, and Yelly Zudith and Mary Dunkel, who had slipped out of Sabishi a month after the shutdown, and Mikhail Yangel up from Dorsa Brevia, and Nadia down from South Fossa. 10 of them. A decimation, Mikhail noted. They ordered bottle after bottle of vodka, as if they could drown the memory of the other 90, including their poor farm crew, who at best had just disappeared on them again, and at worst had been murdered. The Russians among them, strangely, in the majority that night, began to offer up all the old toasts from home. Let's pig up! Let's get healthier! Let's pour behind the cellar! Let's get glassed! Let's get fucked! Let's fill the eyes with it. Let's lick it out.
Let's wet the back of the throat. Let's buy for three. Let's suck it, pour it, knock it, grab it, beat it, flog it, swing it. And so on, until Michelle and Marion Spencer were looking amazed and appalled. It's like Eskimos and snow, Mikhail told them. And then they went back out to dance, the 10 of them forming a line of their own, weaving dangerously through the crowds of youngsters. 50 long Martian years, and still they survived. Still they danced. It was a miracle. But as always, in the all-too-predictable fluctuation of Maya's moods, there came that stall at the top, that sudden downturn. Tonight, begun as she noticed the drugged eyes behind the other masks, saw how everyone was on their way out, doing their best to escape into their own private world where they didn't have to connect with anyone except that night's lover. And they were no different. "Let's go home," she said to Michelle, who was still bouncing along before her in time to the bands, enjoying the sight of all the lean Martian youngsters. "I can't stand this." But he wanted to stay, and so did the others, and in the end she went home by herself, through the gate and the garden and up the stairs to their apartment. The noise of the celebration was loud behind her. And there on the cabinet over the sink, the young Frank smiled at her distress. "Of course it goes this way," the youth's intent look said. "I know this story, too. I learned it the hard way. Anniversaries, marriages, happy moments, they blow away. They're gone. They never meant a thing." The smile tight, fierce, determined. And the eyes. It was like looking in the windows of an empty house. She knocked a coffee cup off the counter and it broke on the floor. The handle spun there, and she cried out loud, sank to the floor, and wrapped her arms around her knees and wept. Then in the new year came news of heightened security measures in Odessa itself. It seemed that UNTA had learned the lesson of Sabishi and was going to clamp down on the other cities more subtly. New passports, security checks at every gate and garage, restricted access to the trains. It was rumored they were hunting the first 100 in particular, accusing them of attempting to overthrow the transitional authority. Nevertheless, Maya wanted to keep going to the Free Mars meetings, and Spencer kept agreeing to take her. "As long as we can," she said. And so one night they walked together up the long stone staircases of the upper town. Michelle was with them for the first time since the assault on Sabishi, and it seemed to Maya that he was recovering fairly well from the blow of the news, from that awful night after Marina's knock on the door. But they were joined at this meeting by Jackie Boone and the rest of her crowd, Antar and the Zygotes, who had arrived in Odessa on the Circumhellas train, on the run from the UNTA troops in the south, and rabidly angry at the assault on Sabishi, more militant than ever. The disappearance of Hiroko and her inner group had sent the ectogenes over the edge. Hiroko was mother to many of them, after all, and they all seemed in agreement that it was time to come out from cover and start a full-scale rebellion. "Not a minute to lose," Jackie told the meeting, if they wanted to rescue the Sabishians and the hidden colonists. "I don't think they got Hiroko's people," Michelle said. "I think they went underground with Coyote." "You wish," Jackie told him, and Maya felt her upper lip curl. Michelle said, "They would have signaled us if they were truly in trouble." Jackie shook her head. "They wouldn't go into hiding again. Now that things are going critical." Dow and Rachel nodded. "And besides, what about the Sabishians and the lockup of Sheffield? And it's going to happen here, too. No, the transitional authority is taking over everywhere. We have to act now." "The Sabishians have sued the transitional authority," Michelle said, "and they're all still in Sabishi walking around."
Jackie just looked disgusted, as if Michelle were a fool, a weak, over-optimistic, frightened fool. Maya's pulse jumped, and she could feel her teeth pressing together.
"We can't act now," she said sharply. "We're not ready."
Jackie glared at her. "We'll never be ready, according to you. We'll wait until they've got a lock on the whole planet, and then we won't be able to do anything even if we wanted to, which is just how you'd like it, I'm sure." Maya shot out of her chair.
"There is no they anymore.
There are 4 or 5 metanationals fighting over Mars, just like they're fighting over Earth. If we stand up in the middle of it, we'll just get cut down in the crossfire. We need to pick our moment, and that has to be when they've hurt each other and we have a real chance to succeed. Otherwise, we get the moment imposed on us, and it's just like 61. It's just flailing about and chaos and people getting killed."
61, Jackie cried. "It's always 61 with you. The perfect excuse for doing nothing. Sabishi and Sheffield are shut down, and Burrows is close. And Heranyag and Odessa will be next.
And the elevator is bringing down police every day, and they've got hundreds of people killed or imprisoned, like my grandmother, who is the real leader of us all, and all you talk about is 61. 61 has made you a coward."
Maya lunged out and slapped her hard on the side of the head, and Jackie leaped on her, and Maya fell back into a table's edge, and the breath whooshed out of her. She was being punched, but managed to catch one of Jackie's wrists, and she bit into the straining forearm as hard as she could, really trying to sever things. Then they were jerked apart and held onto, the room bedlam, everyone shouting, including Jackie, who shouted, "Bitch! Bitch! Bitch! Murderer!" And Maya heard words grating out of her own throat as well. "Stupid little slut! Stupid little slut!" between gasps for air. Her ribs and teeth hurt. People were holding hands over her mouth, and Jackie's too. People were hissing, "Shh! Quiet! They'll hear us! They'll report us! The police will come!" Finally, Michelle took his hand from Maya's mouth, and she hissed, "Stupid little slut!" one last time. Then sat back in a chair and looked at them all with a glare that caught and stilled at least half of them. Jackie was released, and she started to curse in a low voice, and Maya snapped, "Shut up!" so viciously that Michelle stepped between them again. "Towing all your boys around by the cock and thinking you're a leader," Maya snarled in a whisper, "and all without a single thought in your empty head." "I won't listen to this," Jackie cried, and everyone said, "Shh," and she was off, out into the hall. That was a mistake, a retreat, and Maya stood back up and used the time to castigate the rest of them in a tearing whisper for their stupidity, and then, when she had controlled her temper a little, to argue the case for biding their time, the excoriating edge of her anger just under the surface of a rational plea for patience and intention and control, an argument that was essentially unanswerable. All through this peroration, everyone in the room was of course staring at her as if she were some bloodied gladiator, the Black Widow indeed, and as her teeth still hurt from sinking them into Jackie's arm, she could scarcely pretend to be the perfect model of intelligent debate. She felt like her mouth must be puffed up, it throbbed so, and she fought a rising sense of humiliation and carried on, cold and passionate and overbearing. The meeting ended in a sullen and mostly unspoken agreement to delay any mass insurrection and continue lying low. And the next thing she knew, she was slumped on a tram seat between Michelle and Spencer, trying not to cry. They would have to put up Jackie and the rest of her group while they were in Odessa. Theirs was the safe house, after all. So it was a situation she wasn't going to be able to escape. And meanwhile, there were police officers standing in front of the town's physical plant and offices, checking wrists before they let people inside. If she didn't go to work again, they very well might try to track her down to ask why, and if she went to work and got checked, it wasn't certain that her wrist ID and Swiss passport would pass her.
There were rumors that the post-61 balkanization of information was beginning to collapse back into some larger integrated systems which had recovered some pre-war data. Thus, the requirement of new passports. And if she ran into one of those systems, that would be that. Shipped off to the asteroids or to Cassae Vallis to be tortured and have her mind wrecked like Sachs. Maybe it is time, she said to Michelle and Spencer. If they lock up all the cities and the peasts, what other choice do we have? They didn't answer. They didn't know what to do any more than she did. Suddenly the whole independence project again seemed a fantasy, a dream that was just as impossible now as it had been when Arkady had espoused it, Arkady who had been so cheerful and so wrong. They would never be free of Earth, never. They were helpless before it. I want to talk to Sachs first, Spencer said. And Coyote, Michelle said. I want to ask him more about what happened in Sabishi. And Nadia, Maya said, and her throat tightened. Nadia would have been ashamed of her if she had seen her at that meeting, and that hurt. She needed Nadia, the only person on Mars whose judgment she still trusted. There's something odd going on with the atmosphere, Spencer complained to Michelle as they changed trams. I really want to hear what Sachs has to say about it. Oxygen levels are rising faster than I would have expected, especially on North Tharsis. It's like some really successful bacteria has been distributed without any suicide genes in it. Sachs has basically reassembled his old Ekis Overlook team, everyone's still alive, and they've been working at Acheron and Da Vinci on projects they're not telling us about. It's like those damn windmill heaters. So I want to talk to him. We have to get together on this, or else... Or else 61, Maya insisted. I know. You're right about that, Maya. I mean, I agree. I hope enough of the rest of us do. We're going to have to do more than hope. Which meant she was going to have to get out there and do it herself. Go fully underground, move from city to city, from safehouse to safehouse as Nergal had been doing for years, without a job or a home, meeting with as many of the revolutionary cells as she could, trying to hold them on board. Or at least keep them from popping off too soon. Working on the Hellas Sea project wasn't going to be possible anymore. So this life was over. She got off the tram and glanced briefly through the park down the Corniche, then turned and walked up to their gate and through the garden, up the stairwell, down the familiar hall, feeling heavy and old and very, very tired. She stuck the right key into the lock without thinking about it and walked into the apartment and looked at her things, at Michelle's stacks of books, the Kandinsky print over the couch, Spencer's sketches, the battered coffee table, the battered dining table and chairs, the kitchen nook with everything in its place, including the little face on the cabinet by the sink. How many lifetimes ago had she known that face? All these pieces of furniture would go their ways. She stood in the middle of the room, drained and desolate, grieving for these years that had slipped by almost without noticing. Almost a decade of productive work, of real life, now blowing away in this latest gale of history. A paroxysm that she was going to have to try to direct, or at least ride out. Trying her best to nudge it in ways that would allow them to survive. Damn the world. Damn its intrusiveness, its mindless charge, its inexorable roll through the present, wrecking lives as it went. She had liked this apartment, and this town, and this life, with Michelle and Spencer and Diana and all her colleagues at work, all her habits and her music, and her small daily pleasures. She looked glumly at Michelle, who stood behind her in the doorway, staring around as if trying to commit the place to memory. A Gallic shrug. Nostalgia in advance, he said, trying to smile. He felt it too. He understood. It wasn't just her mood this time, but reality itself. She made an effort and smiled back, walked over and held his hand. Downstairs there was a clatter as the Zygote gang came up the stairs. They could stay in Spencer's apartment, the bastards. "If it works out," she said, "we'll come back someday." They walked down to the station in the fresh morning light, past all the cafes, still chairs on tables, wet. At the station, they risked their old IDs and got tickets without trouble, and took a counterclockwise train down to Montepulciano, and got into rented walkers and helmets, and walked out of the tent and down the hill and off the map of the surface world into one of the steep ravines of the foothills. There Coyote was waiting for them in a boulder car, and he drove them through the heart of the Hellespontus, up a forking network of valleys, over pass after pass in this mountain range that was just as chaotic as rock falling from the sky implied, a nightmare maze of a wilderness, until they were down the western slope, past Rabe Crater and onto the crater-ringed hills of the Nueces Highlands. And so they were off the net again, wandering as Maya never had before. Coyote helped a lot in the early part of this period. He wasn't the same, Maya thought, subdued by the takeover of Sabishi, even worried. He wouldn't answer their questions about Hiroko and the hidden colonists. He said, "I don't know," so often that she began to believe him. Especially when his face finally twisted up into a recognizably human expression of distress, the famous invulnerable insouciance finally shattered. "I truly don't know whether they got out or not. I was already out in the mound maze when the takeover started, and I got out in a car as fast as I could, thinking I could help the most from outside. But no one else came out from that exit. But I was on the north side, and they could have gotten out to the south. They were staying in the mound maze, too, and Hiroko has emergency shelters just like I do. But I just don't know." "Then let's go see if we can find out," she said. So he drove them north, at one point going under the Sheffield Burrows Piste, using a long tunnel just bigger than his car. They spent the night in this black slot, restocking from recessed closets and sleeping the uneasy sleep of spelunkers. Near Sabishi, they descended into another hidden tunnel and drove for several kilometers until they came into a small cave of a garage. It was part of the Sabishian's mound maze, and the squared stone caves behind it were like Neolithic passage tombs, now lit with strip lighting and warmed from vents. They were greeted down there by Nanao Nakayama, one of the Issei, who seemed just as cheerful as ever. Sabishi had been returned to them, more or less, and though there were UNTA police in town, and especially at the gates and the train station, the police were still unaware of the full extent of the mound complexes, and so not able to completely stop Sabishi's efforts to help the underground. Sabishi was no longer an open demi-monde, as he put it, but they were still working.
This ends side 1 of cassette 17. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.